Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is Movie Buff owned and operated, and if you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They're constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website early this year, and ordering has never been easier. This includes lots of hard-to-find titles from Scorpion and Code Red. I personally order all my Arrow stuff from them, so I get the limited edition versions. And there's imports from all over the world, including titles like Camera Obscura, CMV, and more. So go to www.diabolikdvd.com. That's spelled DIABOLIKDVD.com.
Now out on Blu-ray, The Devil's Reign from Severin Films, Ernest Borgnine, William Shatner, Ida Lupino, John Travolta, and High Priest of the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey. Lotus Special Edition with new 2K scan, interviews, commentary, trailers, and more. This one has a limited slipcase edition available only from www.severin-films.com. Heaven help us all when the devils reign. Coming soon, also, this is very exciting, the Amicus Collection featuring the incredible Asylum, and Now the Screaming Starts, and The Beast Must Die, and as they say, the most terrifying movie ever made, and one of the movies I've wanted to see most in my life, Threads, because it made the Time Out, or The Guardian, I believe, top 100 horror films of all time. I remember going, what the hell is that? Because I had no idea what it was. It's like a documentary about nuclear war. So that's something to look forward to for completists. Follow Severin Films on Facebook.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. There's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. New this week on Shudder is Sam Was Here. Sam, a door-to-door salesman, travels through the desert in search of clients, with a local radio station as his only contact with the outside world. The strange host, Eddie, takes calls regarding a child killer at large and pushes listeners to hunt the man to death. A paranoid, possibly supernatural mystery, Sam Was Here boasts the intrigue of an extended Twilight Zone episode, forming an evocative thriller you will lean in to figure out. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCKWAVES at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best selection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 75 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
Holy cow, 75, three quarters of a century.
That's right. Can you believe it?
That has been, what, how many years? About a year here?
I think we've been going like two.
Two for this show.
Yeah. Holy cow.
Three or four.
Four.
If you include 140 episodes of Killer People.
It's got to be over four because I gave birth to Marnie.
Oh my God.
While we were doing Killer POV, and she's about to turn five.
I'm going
to
call it, this is the fifth anniversary tonight.
Fifth
anniversary.
I'm calling it. Saying
it's
it.
Random fifth anniversary.
Well, and it's like Killer POV because also with us is Rebecca McKendry.
What up, guys?
And we are down to a three-piece. Ryan is off making movies.
Yep. Yeah, and that's going to be for the rest of the year, probably.
Yeah.
Some more episodes.
He's gone, although we will try to incorporate him into our best of 2017
yeah,
episode.
Yeah, got to have him for the year-end wrap-up.
Somehow. We haven't figured that out yet, but we will. You know, let's just kick right in. I mean,
post
we had the Thanksgiving episode. We were very thankful for a lot of things, including our listeners.
Oh, we got some great feedback from that one, great messages. It was just really nice.
It was cool, and I had a thankful time. I actually didn't watch a lot of movies. I did what Ryan was thankful for, which is play board games.
Oh, cool.
One of which was the Near Impossible Nightmare on Elm Street, the Freddy game, which I played with Ryan. And,
is this the VCR
fiance.
One?
No. I don't know if there's a VCR game. No, but this is... It was a board game that came out around 89. So this is like right at the height of Freddy Mania. And I just remember that at 14 or so, I could not figure out this complicated thing. It was just so bizarre. There's like a bunch of cards and you might be Freddy, you might not be Freddy. I really didn't understand the point. You're going in and out of rooms, whatever. I was hoping it wouldn't be as complicated at 41 as it was at 14. It is. But we are grownups now and we read it through and that's what I love about Ryan is he's like, okay, we're going
to
figure this out.
And
so we did.
And
I will tell you, it was once we got the groove of what it is, which is not that great a game, but it was fun enough. It was really fun. Mike Mendez was with us, filmmaker Mike Mendez. He'll be on before the end of the year as well. And it was just the sort of thing that only nightmare nerds would appreciate. Like, you know, Ryan was playing the new box set that came, the vinyl box set that Mondo put out in the background while we're playing this game. And basically one of the players is Freddy, but you have to try to keep it a secret. And then, you know, once you're outed, you have to try to kill everybody else. And so if Freddy has like his five blade glove card, that means he could kill somebody, but you have two or three cards that can repel him. Like, you know, this is just a dream card. And so
I'm already confused.
It's very confusing. But the whole point of this is I just wanted to get to my favorite part of the story, which was in the middle of playing, and only nerds would do this. Ryan went to kill Mike Mendez, and on cue, he went into his Heather Langenkamp and just screamed out, this is not real. This is just a dream. This is just a dream. it was kind of a funny moment. So I enjoyed that immensely. And then second, Mondo did the Thing board game. Uh-huh. The what's it called? Outpost?
Yeah.
Which I also found a little confusing.
Yes. Okay, here's the thing about the Thing. Yeah. This one I played with Scott Reynolds and his crew. It is a steep learning curve. Like, I think we may have spent 90 minutes reading the instructions and trying to figure out what the fuck you're supposed to do in this game. Like, and then we went to a YouTube video. Like, it was that complicated.
That's exactly what we had to do because we played it as well, where somebody had brought it over to our house and we were like, okay, let's try this out. And it was the same thing where, like, you know, you're trying to focus a group of six adults with drinks and pizza and everything. And then suddenly we were like, we have no idea what's going on. Yeah. And I went off into my office and I'm like, I'm going to go figure this out, guys. And I came back and I was like, I have no idea what's going on.
Yes. No, but that said, as steep as the learning curve is, as soon as we figured it out, like literally like minute 91, when we started the game, it is awesome.
Really?
It is really, really awesome.
We got to stay the course then and keep going.
Yeah, because once you start playing, you strategically as the Thing, if you're the Thing and you know it, and like there's it's pretty much a mind game because you have to pretty much go, there's a threat in every room, basically. You have to go and either accept a chip in every room or there's a threat in every room. And you have to go, you have to choose your team, your members. But if you're the Thing and nobody knows it, then you can strategically sabotage the missions. And that's the thing, you'll never know. So halfway through, we got into like, I don't want to say heated debates, but we were definitely like, what's going on here? Why does the Thing keep defeating us? And it was actually pretty hilarious because, like I said, I played with the Reynolds family and it turned out to be Scott's wife, Amy, was the Thing. And their son caught it immediately. She must not have a poker face. Yeah. Something happened where she was sabotaged and she's like, oh, darn. And he's like, you're the Thing, Mom. You're the Thing. I know it. And she's like, no, I'm not. They were like fighting about it. It was pretty hilarious. And she was the Thing. And she killed us all.
Does it take long to play a round? How long does a game take?
It took a while, but really the biggest chunk was us figuring out the rules and exactly how it went. But once we got into it, it went pretty fast. Okay. And so if you stick it out and really, and again, there's a YouTube video that somebody made.
Yeah.
I think Mondo produced it where they explain the game. Once you get into it, and you know, we had the Thing soundtrack playing, you do feel like you're in the movie. So it's really great. I really recommend it.
That's fun.
Yeah.
But movie-wise, what about you guys?
Well, I will say, if you are into board games, I found a shop in Burbank that literally it's like someone designed a shop for me. It is called Geeky Tees.
Oh.
If you guys haven't been in there yet, it is board games galore. And they're all like, they have everything. I mean, they have like D&D, they've got their Warcraft stuff, but then they've just got weird, crazy, like, you know, independently made games that are just awesome. They also have tea and cats. It's a cat rescue too. So it's literally like somebody was like, what are the three things Becca loves, and kind of put them together. So go there, hug kitties, drink tea, and pick a game. it's awesome. So yeah, Geeky Tees in Burbank.
All righty. Elric, what did you do this fine Thanksgiving
weekend?
Man,
I watched a lot of stuff, but some of it I'll go over brief. You know, I watched The Punisher, the show.
Oh, you want to go there? Let's go there.
You mean, you know, like...
Did you finish it?
I did, actually. I actually was surprised because some of the Marvel shows I haven't watched the last couple because I just, I don't know, I got halfway through one season of Luke Cage and kind of just never picked it up and then didn't make it to Iron Fist because of that. And then Defenders got here and I was like, ah, shit. But when Punisher came up, somebody said, yeah, you don't have to have, you know, gone there. And
it's the one that's the most separate.
Yeah,
like doesn't even feel like it's part of the world.
I really liked it. I liked the micro story a lot. I had a lot of heart to it. I think he is a great Punisher. I think he's a great Frank Castle. He wasn't Punisher much of it, but he really was a fascinating Frank Castle. He's so intense, Bernthal. Yeah. Bernthal's a good actor. And, you know, I've seen all the Punisher versions that have ever existed. I used to read War Journal and Punisher. So, I liked it. I wish maybe they could have more of the Punisher, you know, what he will become, but I guess that's why you watch the next season.
Yeah, well, he did. He was for a good chunk. I loved it.
It's violent as hell.
I loved it. I mean, a lot of people, as always, complain about the pacing of these shows. I will say that I thought the first, I liked all of it, but the first three could have been a little more truncated. And that has a lot to do with, you know, him. Look, if you read the comics, you know that Microchip's his sidekick pretty much. And so them going back and forth between who Micro is for three episodes, a little, let's just get to that story already. Yeah. And then Marvel, unfortunately, falls into the same, almost every show where they do the same two twists mid-season. Yeah. And this show does the same thing. Yeah. That said, I was really fascinated by, because I like the over-the-top Punisher of Punisher Warzone, the Lexi Alexander movie, and the Garth Ennis comic books. Like, I don't like to take it seriously, because when you start thinking about what that character is really going through, it's pretty dark shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of a straight, you know, version narrative of it, I thought this was really terrific, and I love how they played into the whole PTSD of, you know, what people that go to war have to kind of go through when they come back to, you know, I thought.
Because there's multiple victims of that, not just him. It's a big part of the story.
Yeah. And I tried to space this one out, but then, like, I started marathoning chunks like two or three at a time.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, I was just so blown away because they I think episode 11 and then 13, which is the finale, the sheer violence in there, there's
crazy.
Several things that I had to turn away from.
Yeah.
I thought it was just
there's some
unbelievable.
There,
wow.
Yeah, it's really, really gnarly, but I loved it.
Rick Grimes wouldn't have stood a chance if Punisher had been the John Bernthal
no
he came
way.
Up against. That would have been a different
no
story.
Way. Yep.
So that was a bit of fun. I finally got to, on Thanksgiving night, the one movie I hadn't seen of Thanksgiving was Home Sweet Home, which was obviously a VHS copied version onto YouTube, which is, I guess, the only place I could see it. It's a terrible copy. The movie isn't much better. It's not like Blood Rage, where I felt myself stumbling onto some yearly gem I was going to want to revisit for fun. This was more like, oh, now I've ticked that box.
Huh.
This is Body by Jake, the big guy who was Body by Jake.
Oh, yeah. I remember
every episode of Body by Jake is more entertaining than this movie. Every single episode. But the opening is awesome. The opening is like him just like beating a guy and screaming, then driving a car. He's like a, I guess they kind of imply like a PCP addict or a mental asylum escapee. And he's driving down the street. And he runs over an old woman and just cuts the title. And he's basically heading home to the weirdest, most eclectic Thanksgiving dinner you've ever seen. It's just the strangest group of people. One of them happens to be a mime with an electric guitar who keeps interrupting anyone when they're about to have sex. And he is straight away tweeted like, oh, great. I guess Franklin's off the hook as the most annoying character in cinema's history because this guy is vying for it. But the one cool thing is there's a little girl in it, and I didn't know who she was. She had, you know, a small role in it. But at the end, it said Vanessa Shaw, and I remember her from Eyes Wide Shut and a lot of movies,
mm-hmm.
a lot of horror movies.
Wow.
And I've always thought she was really good. Obviously, the Hills Have Eyes remake. You know, this is definitely a curio. I think I got to say, with this one, unlike Microwave Massacre, where I just personally really didn't like it, this is more like I didn't really enjoy watching it. But man, if this was playing in a theater with a group of people, I think it would be a lot of fun because it's got so many absurdities. The tone is just kind of ludicrous. So I can see why so many people have a soft spot for it and want it to come out. And I'm not sure if it's a rights issue. I would assume so because I know a lot of people have been looking for this one for years. But it did complete my Thanksgiving horror needs that I needed on the day because I hadn't seen that one. But yeah, I can't say I recommend it necessarily. And then kind of on a Thanksgiving theme, I really bummed I didn't get to talk to Ryan about this before he left, but I loved Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh,
it's kind of a no-brainer that I would,
see it.
But its dialogue is so interesting. It's definitely black comedy, but about as dark as it gets in terms of comedy, and it has got real violence and weird supernatural stuff that is largely unexplained. So
It's the kind
of
movie
that... Is that on Amazon yet?
No, I think it's still in theaters. It's the kind of movie that will piss a lot of people off. Let me be honest. Like, there's a lot of... I'm not saying it's not for everyone. It's not that kind of comment. It's more like some people would watch a movie like this and go, fuck you, I don't get this. What is this? It's stupid. But if you've seen any of... I don't want to say his name out loud without embarrassment, but Yorgos Lanthimos, the Greek filmmaker, he's an excellent filmmaker. Dogtooth is excellent. Lobster's really interesting. Like, some people fall in, like, I like the first half of that, and then I don't know. You know, wherever you fall in it, I think... Colin Farrell is one of those actors who I never liked, and now I have to accept that he's an amazing actor. Like, in this movie, he's amazing. And in Bruges, amazing. Like, there's enough movies back-to-back now that I have to realize, oh, no, he's actually a great actor.
I think so.
He's hilarious in this. Alicia Silverstone is in one scene of this, and she's hilarious in it. It's also really dark, though. It's got the underpinning is insanely dark, and I had a couple next to me who were clearly on a blind date, knew nothing about the movie, and the girl would laugh out loud and then get really quiet and go, what is this? Like, she didn't even understand that was a movie. She couldn't figure out how it worked, and yet she was genuinely laughing because it's also really funny. So I wish I could talk to her. I'll talk a little bit more about that probably when I get to my top 10, because I think that one's going to push its way in there. It's really cool, and I think if you get a chance to see it with a crowd, it might work better because of the comedy. You might at home wonder if it's meant to be funny.
Right.
It's that kind of darkness. So, but I got a few more, but let's keep rolling around.
Yeah, what'd you see back
there? Excellent. So I will talk about Island of Terror from 1966. This is from Scream Factory, and I have a two watch shelf in my living room, which is like all of the Blu-rays that I'm like, someday I will watch this. I have not seen it yet. And it had been sitting there for a while, and we were at Thanksgiving, and like the kids had been nuts. We decided to take them to see Santa on Thanksgiving Day, which was just equally nuts. And like we're on the way back home, and Dave literally looks at me and he says, like, do you want to go home, drink beer, and watch Peter Cushing movies? And I was like, that might be my favorite pickup line ever. Yeah. So yes, let's go do that. So we got home and put in 1966's Island of Terror, directed by Terrence Fisher, which is usually like an indicator for me of like, okay, I'm going to enjoy this. Uh-huh. So the setup is that there is a remote island of scientists who have been trying to cure cancer. And so they're like toying around with DNA and genetics. And in the process of trying to cure cancer, they accidentally create this giant blob monster with a tentacle who dissolves bones. Mm-hmm. And they reproduce by splitting in half every 6 hours. So after they create one, they realize that they've pretty much doomed mankind within about 48 hours. Peter Cushing comes in as the really smart doctor who's going to help them figure out the problem. He is creepy as fuck in this movie, and he's supposed to be like the savior who comes in to save the day. He proposes a threesome with our like strapping young couple within like the first 20 minutes, where they're like making,
you won't know unless you ask.
Yeah, they're like making like flirty sexual innuendos, and he comes up and he goes, can this game have a third player? And you're like, ew, weird, man, weird. And then the other strange thing about this is he keeps drugging women. Like, because people on the island are dying. So it starts out, I'll say rather, you know, we'll say nicely, where a woman's husband dies and he's like, she's hysterical, give her a sedative. And then like 10 minutes later, he's like, that woman's hysterical, give her a sedative. And he keeps giving people sedatives. And you're like, what up with that, Cushing? And then at one point, he gets attacked by the monster. And so then one of the doctor comes in and is like, do you require a sedative? And he goes, what are you trying to do? Turn me into a junkie? And you're like, but you've been drugging people the whole time. The movie definitely has some, I'll call it dated gender issues, but it's fun. And Marnie ended up...
it's hard to fault them on that one. Yeah,
you can't.
But I got to admit, I don't like seeing Cushing. I mean, I like him in everything, but I much prefer Cushing when he's the good guy. He's one of those actors I always want. He's so likable. But when he plays like villain or slimy or rapey, like he didn't play rapey very much, but towards the end of the career, they kind of pushed him. And I always felt bad for him because it felt kind of sad.
He's supposed to be the good guy in this one. So you can't fault him on the gender issues. It is 1966. There is one female in the entire movie, and she pretty much just hangs out while the husbands do all of the math and things like that. And so you can't really fault them on that. They spend a lot of time at this British pub, which has all these fox heads on the wall. Like, it looks like the pub is mostly made out of dead foxes. Uh-huh. So I was amused by that as well. But yeah, it's fun. It's you know, a fun monster movie. The monsters are good enough that you're like, I'm in with it, but still kind of clunky enough that you're like, oh, that's good. Marnie ended up waking up midway through, and she came out and watched the rest with us. So it's nothing that's really heavy. Okay. But still, a lot of fun. Island of Terror, 1966 from Scream Factory.
Nice.
Wow. I saw, believe it or not, because it's been several months, but I finally got around to checking out Annabelle Creation.
Wow.
The prequel to Annabelle. Forgive me, David, if you're listening. But I have been listening to the music for the score from it ever since. It's the same composer did it. But no, I mean, basically now it's that we are...
Is this just come out on VOD? What's the story?
Yeah, it's on Blu-ray. I rented on Amazon for like $3. It's already officially available everywhere. Yeah, okay. But yeah, no, I missed some of the bigger movies like this. I didn't get a chance to see Jigsaw. And now that the year is kind of winding down, we're trying to catch up. So when we do our best of the year sort of deal. And I really like this film a lot. I think the director David Sandberg, who also did Lights Out, is the real deal in terms of much in the same way that James Wan just has a knack for orchestrating really suspenseful moments and setting up a great scare. Yeah. I think he's got it down pat.
I feel like when you talk about them as gags, that's about as good as Guess, man.
Yeah.
They're as good as Guess.
The set pieces are amazing.
And I know some people don't like that. And I have said, I've raved about this to some people who've said, but I don't like that. It's like, okay, I get that. But in the theaters, it's played like gangbusters.
Yeah.
No, like the whole audience was just being played. You know?
Yeah, no, and it's fun. I mean, because most people don't have the appetite for horror like we do. And so that's the thing is when you're sitting with somebody that it easily scares.
Yeah.
This is just like a nonstop roller coaster for those type of people. But even for me as a hardened horror fan, I liked it a lot. And more importantly, it's funny because the poster advertises it as kind of the next chapter in the Conjuring universe, which I sort of understood. I was like, oh, I get it. I guess it's because it's the prequel to Annabelle. Annabelle is a movie that I don't like that much, the first one.
It felt very manufactured to me.
It's a big misstep for what that franchise is. It's not as strong, obviously, as what James did with Conjuring and Conjuring 2. But what's interesting about this movie, here's an interesting trend in horror in the last decade or so, is I love when sequels course correct or retcon a previous movie that's not so good and hence makes the franchise great again. Ouija did it like perfectly. The Ouija Origin of Evil is actually really great. And when you stick around for the post-credit scene of that, it ties into the first movie and makes the first one better. I also feel that way about the Paranormal Activity movies because I had not liked the first one when I saw it initially. I was like, I don't understand why people love this. Yeah. And it was only recently that I saw part two, and I wasn't even sure I was liking part two. But then by the time you get to end, the way that it wraps into one, I'm like, wow, Paranormal 2 actually made one better. And I hear that I'm up to part three. I haven't seen it. Yeah. I hear three does that
really
as
good.
Well. And so I think it's fascinating when you do this. And so this movie doesn't really feel like a sequel or a prequel, but it feels like the movie needed to fix the entire franchise because they reference, I mean, I'm sure it's not a spoiler, but they reference The Nun, which is the next movie that's coming out. And basically, my biggest the thing that's like a fundamental mistake in the first Annabelle is completely fixed with this movie. This movie actually kind of retcons it and still makes it work. Like it doesn't like change it. It just gives you a slightly different perspective that now everything we've been told makes sense. And so I think that's kind of an amazing
thing. Also had a good emotional story, like I got people making like dolls and then the grief you suffer from the losing your daughter. It's like, that's a good setup.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it had the guy, what's his name? Anthony
LaPaglia,
who's in Innocent Blood.
Innocent Blood, yeah.
So, good cast and just thoroughly entertaining.
And for those who haven't
rented
it, see, I'm the type who, if he hadn't made that, I kind of hated the first one, to be honest, besides the scene in the elevator, which later I found out James Wan did.
Yes.
Like, because that scene was scary. What's so cool about this movie is I went into it, it's a creepy doll movie, okay, I'm watching, and then suddenly I'm watching, and this isn't really a spoiler, you'll get into it. It's a full-on demon, scary as hell kind of thing, and I was like, whoa, so now it's not just a...
It's not really a doll. It's not really about the doll at all.
Which makes, and even though there's some really great moments with the doll, and his gags that he takes from his short films are kind of, some of them are recycled particularly well. I don't know, I just think it's a lot of fun. I think people, this would be a nice surprise for those who think they won't like it.
Yeah.
It might really surprise them.
And now I'm looking forward to Corin Hardy's The Nun, which is actually...
Yes,
in Romania and a period piece. Because they reference it in here, but that's what it is.
So
it's
that's
going to be a lot of fun.
That's going to give it some good production value too.
And it's a prequel to Mulholland Drive. Everything's probably a prequel to every movie ever made.
You can make that claim everywhere.
It's a prequel. Yeah. Hey, going from that good movie to a really movie that I watched, so you won't have to. Amityville: The Awakening. Hello.
I saw an early cut of this, so I'm guessing that it kind of got retooled. But it felt sleazy like part two for me in parts.
They totally shot way more after you saw it. I remember when you saw it.
I saw it a while ago. And I will say I liked the original one, whatever. I don't know what they released, but I liked it when I first saw it, because I will say it wasn't like a mass release movie what I saw, but it felt sleazy like part two.
I don't often feel like I've wasted, you know, like when I watch even not great horror films, don't we feel like I wasted my time? This is definitely one of those ones where you go like, there's nothing about this that feels like you're trying to break new ground or make a new movie. It just felt worn to me. And there's a couple interesting choices about lore, you know, that it tries to remix. But man, it just, even the, you know, the lead actress, the one from Babysitter.
Oh, yeah. What's her name?
The side Thorne. Bella Thorne. Yeah, Bella Thorne.
Just, you know, just shots of her kind of like wearing her pasty to bed. She's like the 16-year-old daughter. And just stuff like that, which I feel like it's just kind of – just doesn't feel – I don't want to say appropriate like an old person, but it just – there's something about it I felt was really bland, lacked – you know, I'm not even going to waste my time talking about it personally. For me, it didn't work. If you're an Amityville completist, you might get something out of it.
Did it still get meta?
Only a little bit, in the sense that somebody at school says, oh, you moved into the house. Oh, you got to watch the Amityville films.
Okay. That's
which is kind of funny.
Man,
you're like, okay,
that was
good.
Like
so
a
that's
focal
real.
Point.
Yeah. That didn't bother me. It just, I don't know. There's just something about it. Just one of those movies you watch and go, oh, it looks like a lot might've gone wrong here.
No. And it did. And yeah, it did. Yeah. Maybe one day we'll get to share those stories.
Yeah. With everyone involved.
Who knows? But you know what? I'm actually curious about, cause Dan Farrens, who has a long history of horror, uh-huh. and I think he's been on our show before. Yeah.
On Killer POV.
Yeah. We had him on Killer POV.
You know, he wrote and originally tried to produce. I mean, I think he's credited as a producer on that film.
Yeah.
Although they ended up changing a lot of what his original pitch was. And so the movie they put out is not really what he envisioned to be that Amityville movie.
Yeah.
And so he went and wrote and directed his own Amityville movie, which is based on what it should have been. And it's called The Amityville Murders. And so that one's coming out next year. And he even got, I don't know, it's more focused on the DeFeos, but he, which is kind of Amityville too, and as a fun nod, he actually brought Diane Franklin back.
She
in a different role.
Part two.
So that's the one I'm really looking forward to because, and Burt Young's listed in the credits.
Whoa.
How is that possible?
Oh, maybe there's a flashback though.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's
so
fun.
So that's the one I'm looking forward to because I know, I think Dan has not been secretive on his disappointment of what happened in the new movie. So
how can the rights just be everyone can keep calling movie Amityville whatever they want?
I guess so. It's one of those things where I don't think
maybe it's a true crime, so you can't own. The
yeah, I don't think anyone can own Amityville, like the word.
The
hence, room. I mean, I literally looked it up, and something called Amityville Creation Cup that came up. Yeah. So who knows what the hell that is?
Wow,
that David looks like
Sandberg's
a doll.
It's
a little doll face on the cover. Like who the hell made this?
Oh man!
So it's like a hodgepodge, like a mixing of ripoff films.
Oh god, I love
it's
it.
I'll run through a couple of indies quickly, just because there's. I finally saw We Are the Flesh.
Oh,
the crazy one that you've been telling me to see for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's pretty interesting. it's kind of a horror film. It's kind of just an intense, weird sex, intense, kind of cannibalistic
allegory.
Yeah. Like it's an interesting movie. It doesn't quite tick my, even though it's kind of, it ticks my art house kind of box. They're saying, I found it hypnotic to watch, but at a certain point I was like, like, you know, it didn't really do it for me. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because it was like a bit of a turn off and just kind of gross. But the intensity, let me put it this way. That's the kind of movie when it ends, I think to myself, I'll watch whatever that director does next. Like,
yes,
I'll be very
too.
Interested. But for me, maybe this isn't quite my bag.
It's the same way I felt after Dogtooth, where I was like, I am horrified by this film. I did not like anything in it. I will watch whatever this dude does next.
But it's definitely interesting. But yeah, I think some people that I could see why it would do so well, and Arrow put that one out. I saw another one, released by Arrow, that I won at trivia from you, called The Ghoul. And
I watched that. I talked about it on the show a couple of weeks ago.
So it's Ben Wheatley produced or executive produced. I thought this film was interesting at times as a procedural, but it didn't ever really come together.
That's exactly what I said. Was
strange
that,
one, yeah.
Yeah, I liked the setup. I liked what it was trying to do. I liked the idea that it was bending time a little bit, and you didn't know if it was bending time or if it was in the guy's head.
Yeah, a cop going undercover to solve a murder that you then start to wonder if he's imagined it or is the actual killer
or
it just blurred. It's trying to be kind of like a Lost Highway thing, but to me a lot less successful because the guy doesn't have as good a the director has a grasp of the tone maybe.
And so then his identity gets called into question, but then time kind of becomes an issue too. And so, yeah, I thought that it did a lot of really interesting stuff, but it didn't go anywhere. And it was so soft spoken that for a crime thriller, it was really boring in parts.
Yeah, it's pretty, well, there's a lot of sitting down with psychiatrists. There's a lot of different psychiatrist characters. Interesting if you like police procedurals and kind of surreal realism. Mm-hmm. It kind of flips between the two. I kind of liked it, but didn't. It wasn't really for me. But one I really liked and do want to recommend to people is actually a Glass Eye Pick, a brand new Glass Eye Picks film that I didn't realize that when I rented it. It had won South by last year and called Most Beautiful Island. And it's directed by Ana Asensio, who I had no idea while I was watching it is the absolutely gorgeous star of it. She looks, you know, like a beautiful foreign model. She also directed it. And I guess she is married to one of those directors who often make their movies through Glass Eye Picks. It could be the We Are What We Are guy, or it's one of those guys. She's definitely married to one of them. And what it is basically is very minimal. It's like an 80-minute film, and it's all more or less real time. And it's just her. She's an immigrant, doesn't have much money in New York City. She is told she's kind of grieving, but it's been a few years. Maybe she lost a child. It doesn't go too into detail about her backstory. And she's working the streets just like selling chicken or something mm-hmm. for a fried chicken place. And her coworker, who's another, is a Russian girl. I think she's Spanish. Or maybe no, she's like Croatian, I think. And the Russian girl says to her, oh, you can make, you know, like $4,000 just by going to this party. I know I can't make it this time. You should go. And you don't have to do anything. Like, you don't actually have to sexually do anything. You just have to look good and they'll look at you and that's it. And she's like, really? That sounds too good to be true. Of course it is. tells her where to get the part, you know, to get a dress and stuff. So you follow her for the day trying to get her thing. There's a really creepy scene with her in a bath of cockroaches at her house. That's super bizarre. And you're like, oh, what? Is there something wrong with her? Like, it's just interesting. But you're really watching it. You're really in her perspective. And then she goes to this event. So this, I'm not going to go past here because it's kind of all leading up to it. And once she gets to the event, it becomes probably the most tense 25 minutes, I think, of the year. Like, that's what's interesting. The first 40 minutes is just following her walking around, and you kind of just start watching it. The next 25 minutes, and that's the whole movie, is just this one kind of sequence. It's almost like an 80-minute sequence, if you know what I mean. Larry Fessenden is the doorman. I can tell you that. and there's a couple other people, including people from Shudder I recognized, and listeners of a show who appear as extras in this one key sequence. But the actual tension she is able to milk from just this kind of really simple setup is why I love Glass Eye Picks and why I love indie films, is the sense that it's just this little thing that no one would ever fund mm-hmm. on a big scale because it's too, in a sense, minor, because it's just this little 80 minutes of, say, this woman's existence. But because somebody did get to make it, and especially because she got to make it with her perspective and probably, you know, her nudity and all of that, because she's in charge, it's her film. She can film her body how she wants. There's a real matter of factness to it, and it really works. I really dig this movie. I think people into indie films, if you're not really into especially their kind of films and, you know, Jeremy Gardner stuff, I just think mm-hmm. it has a nice stripped down quality. I thought it was really appealing, and it was a nice little, that's definitely one of the surprises I've had in a while. The only reason I even pushed play was because somebody recently told me, oh, I heard that, you know, was interesting and mentioned South by winning South by. So I was like, yeah, I didn't even really know it's horror. It's kind of only kind of horror, but
it's not listed in horror under Amazon. It's listed as suspense, and it's not well rated, but the reviews for it are great.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing, if you went to Letterboxd, I think a lot of people would probably be going, oh, this is an interesting film, but they would tell you it's not traditional, you know, thing. I thought it was really cool.
It is $6.99 to rent on Amazon. And while I was looking at this, sorry guys, sidebar. Mm-hmm. While I was looking at this on Amazon right now, I just got recommended a new horror anthology from Cracked. That I didn't even know existed. So
you just paid for that advertising.
I did. Wow. I didn't even know this existed, so I'm going to have to check that out. But yeah, I won't say another word till I do.
A good little indie. And that's the one I won't go into. I saw another South by called Barracuda. This is because this is me and Ultra.
That's the Texas director, right? Julie Halpern?
Yeah, and it was two people, but it's about a sister who comes back to Texas to meet her sister. They never knew about each other. Their dad was a country and western star, and you think the whole movie that she's just kind of coming back for an inheritance, like mm-hmm. trying to play, but she's really violent, kind of like not right in the head.
It's something to do with the music industry,
and there's music,
right?
It's a little too, the only reason I'm bringing it up is because I think they're selling it kind of like it has a horror element, which it does, but you know, when slow burn to me means it's burning the whole way, you know, when I think people's problems with slow burn is usually because it does, like Ty West films to me aren't really slow burn because they're actually burning the whole time. There's always something going on. It's not like they're just randomly somebody just hanging out. There's still tension. I felt like this didn't have tension for like long periods of time. The acting's phenomenal and the worldview, it just for me, and I did again another, I'm kind of lumping these together, I guess, just because I was doing this indie drive. for me, it was a well-made film, but in the horror circle, if you're a horror, I don't know if you'll find that satisfying. but you know, it was well put together. I thought it was cool.
Okay.
Okay.
Those are the horror.
Well, I have been on a murder mystery kick as of late. So right before the last show that we had before Thanksgiving, I talked about Angel Heart. Mm-hmm. And then over Thanksgiving, we went to see Murder on the Orient Express, which I really enjoyed the murder mystery angle. The film itself had some flaws, but I really enjoyed the murder mystery angle of it. And I've also been binge watching the British series Sherlock, which if you haven't seen, it's the Benedict Cumberbatch one, where it's not even like a series with like TV shows. They are like full length movies, like they're 90 minutes long. Yeah. And there's only like three per season because they're like 90 minutes long. And even though it's not horror, some of them have a very giallo feel to them. And a lot of them are serial killer based. So it feels very like horror murder mystery. So with that, one, I'm looking for more horror murder mysteries, so please send me some recommendations on Twitter. But I went back and I watched The Oxford Murders, which is Alex de la Iglesia's one. From 2010. And I had seen this when it first came out. And I believe when it first came out, I didn't see it right when it first came out. I watched it a couple of years later because I think I talked about it on like our first or second episode of Killer POV. It was like way long ago. So I went back and rewatched this. And it's still my review of it. I was more interested in it now than I was before. When I first watched it, I think I referred to it as Math the Movie.
Oh, yeah. I remember now that you say that, I remember you reviewing this all those years ago.
That's I was like, it's a lot of math. And like, I love murder mysteries, but dude, I was just like, I get it. And I get the whole, you know, what's going on. But it was just a lot of equations to try to figure out, to the point that I was like, I need like a degree in math to be able to do this movie. And it also, because it is Alex de la Iglesia, his movies are usually fucking nuts. Yeah. I mean, like,
we should mention he did Day of the Beast, and the ones I love is The Last Circus and Witching and Bitching.
And he did Perdita Durango.
Yeah.
Like, with most of his films, you're like waiting for it to go off the rails because at some point a truckload full of fetuses is going to crash into the door and it's going to get fucking nuts. And so this is the most tame movie, not that he's ever done. Like, this is just across the board a tame movie. Like, it feels
very
classic.
Could have been a chance to try to make a mainstream film and it didn't necessarily pay off.
I think that may have been what it was, especially because he uses Elijah Wood and John Hurt. So it felt like this was like his foray from these like batshit crazy Spanish movies into I'm going to make a very classic British murder mystery. And so that's what this is. Even the colors, it's like a very, very muted color palette. The whole thing just feels very white and washed out. And then it's got all this math in it. And at the same time, it is an interesting murder mystery. I liked it more this time than before because on the second watching, I was like, okay, I'm beginning to figure out kind of where they're heading with it and some more of the minutia of it. So it did become kind of Da Vinci Code where it's, you know, pulling from math and history and science and these philosophers and things like that. It's very polarizing online. I was reading some of the reviews and people were like, this is an amazing film. This is utter garbage. There was really like nothing in between. But yeah, if you're into horror murder mysteries, I definitely recommend checking it out. Elijah Wood, I still don't know what to make of his acting in it just because he literally has no character. Like, his character is just very subdued. It's very flat. And it just feels like if you stripped all the personality out of Elijah Wood, this is what you'd be left with. Like, he literally just felt like an empty shell in it. So I'm still not sure what to make of his acting in it. But that said, cool story, cool murders. Recommend checking it out if you're into kind of the mystery horror thing. And send me some more recommendations because I'm hungry for more.
I do like murder mysteries.
Yeah, I'm looking for ones. I mean, giallos are great, but I've seen lot of giallos. So.
And that's mystery. Like, that's not really like a buildup of what the mystery is.
Yeah.
It's just like who's the killer usually.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And murder mysteries are kind of rare, I think.
Yeah.
You know? And horror, they're rare.
So I'm hungry for more things like Angel Heart or The Oxford Murders. Yeah, okay. Send me some recs.
I'll have to think about that myself. Yeah,
I got two more, cool. Which I'll do quick. I don't have a lot to say about either, but The Being, Jackie Kong's 1983 debut, came out on Blu-ray through Code Red.
Oh.
If you can believe it, yeah, I bought it on Diabolik DVD, which is one of our sponsors. I think that's where I got it from. But anyway, it's an interesting film. I'd never seen it, but I remember that when you saw it, Elric, in the Killer POV days, it spawned the hashtag Kong as King.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So between Blood Diner and this, you are a true believer.
I actually preferred The Being to Blood Diner. I still do. I think it's just a lot more fun and
it
crazy.
Is.
Well, it's
I
fun,
love the effects.
And it's a little bit more straightforward of a creature. It's a creature feature that it feels. It's interesting. You know, I haven't listened to the commentary yet. I know she did a new commentary for it, but it feels like it easily just could have been a Corman movie, like from that, like that era of the early 80s, you know, like Humanoids from Beyond the Deep, like stuff like in that era. Mm-hmm. Like it just feels much, very much like that. But you know, Martin Landau's in it. And it is basically a kind of mutant creature that's making his way through this little town. And they're what are they trying to cover it up or just kill this thing? I kind of only half remembered what's going on. I remember the creature looked cool.
The opening at a movie theater is really cool.
Yes, yes, that's, yes.
I always love – I want a big long list of all the things that are always at a drive-in, any movie ever with drive-in scenes because I love those. Like Blood Rage and that. They're both great.
I'm sure that list has got exists.
It's probably on somewhere.
Yeah. Somebody's got that. So The Being, if you've been looking for it, the Blu-ray looks great and it is available through Code Red.
The Kong is still king.
And Kong is still king. She's yes, still... absolutely. And it's great that her first two movies are available this way. Now all we need is what's the big
the
comedy
night
she did?
Thing. Yeah.
The Night Patrol. Mm-hmm. We need that on Blu-ray and then we're in good shape. Mm. And also, I know this may sound weird as a horror recommendation, but it absolutely is. I really like the animated DC movies. And so they just put out something called Justice League Dark. Mm-hmm. And it lives up to the title. There's some pretty dark, it's rated R. Hmm. And there's some dark shit that happens in them. There was a period where I thought they could do no wrong with their animated stuff. Like it was just so much more fun than what they were trying to do in the movies. Yeah. And then they started matching the tone of the movies, like the Zack Snyder stuff, like the Batman v Superman. And I was like, man, these are like depressing. Like I want to watch animated movies to have fun. And so what's cool about this one, Justice League Dark, is there are people that are running around that are seeing demons and trying to murder them when they're actually just regular people. They're just seeing them as demons.
Oh,
so there's
wow.
literally a woman in her car that sees a bunch of demons on the street and she starts mowing them down. And it's only after when they like yank her out that she realizes she just ran over a bunch of regular people. And so some supernatural force is making people see things. Mm. And so who do they call in? Mr. John Constantine from Hellblazer.
Oh, nice choice.
And reprising the role is Matt Ryan, who played him on the TV show, does the voice for it. And so here's where it gets cool. This is like, I assume, what Del Toro was trying to pitch as a movie. So the Justice League is not the Justice League. Like, yes, Superman's in it briefly, and so is Wonder Woman, but it's basically John Constantine teaming up with Batman and then recruiting Deadman, Zatanna, Etrigan the Demon, and even freaking Swamp Thing.
Oh, I thought for some reason it would be Man-Thing or something. Huh.
No, Man-Thing is a Marvel character. Swamp Thing was the DC version, and Alan Moore had redefined the character. So it's like, if you want to see all of – and it's really fun. Like, a lot of the weird shit that's happening around them – you know, like there's one great bit where there's all these wreaths that are like, you know, like basically like Grim Reapers around Constantine, like, we're waiting for you. And then like rush up to Batman and they're like, you have evaded us many, many times. And he's just the way Batman reacts to all this. I was just like, literally, there's all this crazy supernatural shit happening around him. He's just like, okay.
Yeah.
So
he is a grounded character.
He's the grounded one from the real world, all of a sudden dealing with all this stuff. So it is great fun. And if you're a horror fan, to me, this feels like something I would watch every Halloween because it's all my favorite, like, supernatural characters from the DC world in an animated movie.
Yeah.
And a rated R one for adults, too. So
I'd still love to see Marvel do the whole Blade Runner, Ghost Rider, that kind of world, that dark Cloak and Dagger, that whole.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like those characters could be a whole
Blade,
other.
Blade, not Blade Runner.
Sorry. Yeah,
Blade.
Yeah, Blade. Sorry. Yeah. Blade. Well, because there was, I think it's called Spirits of Vengeance. There's a comic.
Yes.
And it was the two of them together. It was awesome. And it was so dark. And I was like, man, that's just, you could rebrand a whole other stream of Marvel.
Oh, sure. Yeah. We're not that far away from that, I don't think.
We'll save that for our new comic book podcast.
So that's all I got for now.
Nice.
I got one more to lay on you because it's a biggie.
I got one
more too.
My favorite movie of my holiday.
What? Favorite?
Of the break.
Of the break. Okay. Of the 4 days.
Let me just play you a couple notes. Becca, let me play you a couple notes on my saxophone. Woo, woo, woo. Where am I playing it? No, that'd be sexual harassment. I can't do that to you.
The Devil's Honey.
The Devil's Honey by Lucio Fulci.
Oh, dude.
Holy
I
mother.
Just got my copy of that
Holy
today.
Holy balls. Okay, what I will say, this is going to be good for those who think it's just going to be a WTF movie, because, of course, the first 10 minutes is so outrageous. Like, there's part of me that's watching and then just like kind of almost like a cartoon shaking my face at what I'm watching.
Amazing.
But it's also really funny and crazy. But after that, it still has many moments that are, you know, crazy sex moments and crazy over the top WTF moments. But after that, it also has this like quite serious pathos to it. And like this
I guess because Fulci's just such a weird director, and I love him. So I'm coming. This is definitely from a place of love. I found it really interesting, the rest of the story as it built, because it went somewhere I didn't expect. It becomes largely a sexual revenge story and a story of loss. And
it definitely feels like two movies.
Yeah, it's definitely two movies, but in a way that got me. Like, once I was in it, I was like, okay, cool. Now I'm in this. I laughed. I had fun. And now I'm in this very strange, darker thing. But like, one of the great things about this Blu-ray is it has Stephen Thrower, who I'm just a big fan of Nightmare USA, and he does a really good breakdown of it. So as soon as the movie ended, I was like, okay, what did I just watch? Because I know I enjoyed it, but I was also like, man, that's pretty crazy, even by Fulci standards. And Stephen Thrower like just talks about it and contextualizes it for Fulci, that basically this is obviously late-ish Fulci, and he got incredibly sick and was almost bedridden for a whole year from, I think, a bout with hepatitis. And as he recovered, he had basically written the same story and sold it while he was in bed, and somebody else directed almost the exact same movie. He got out and realized, that was a good story. I want to do it myself now. And then so basically creates this movie. And so this is like his comeback after all that pain. And I think a lot of that kind of personal pain and kind of some of the feverishness of it, I feel, maybe comes into the movie a bit. Mm-hmm. I really liked where the movie went. And I thought it was I think this isn't just a Room type, like, whoa, it's a crazy movie. Bye. I think there's something about this. I'll be thinking about this for a while. I really genuinely dug it and thought, to me, it's a lot more interesting than Cat in the Brain, some of his later films, which are really quite weak, some of the very last couple. This is probably the best last movie. But hey, I won't underplay that opening. Like, as soon as I finished, I was thinking, like, on Twitter, I was like, oh, I can't think of anything I'd rather watch than the making of that first scene. Like, to watch Fulci directing a guy getting a saxophone, being it played between his lover's legs while everyone's in the other room recording. You're just like, I would love to see how you direct that scene. I have no idea how. I would be too embarrassed.
Okay, I'm totally. I just got my copy of this today.
And it's short.
Sitting on my
desk. Nice, it's a nice 80-something minute film. Fulci lives. That's what I'll say.
I love it. Yeah.
So the last thing I'll talk about is that I am rereading Meg. Mm-hmm. In preparation of the movie coming on August 10th, 2018, I have decided to read.
Who's making it? Eli Roth was making it at one point.
It's John Turtlebaum now.
What? Starring Jason Bond. What's his name?
Jason Statham. And but it's the director is the same guy who did the National Treasures movie. So it's like I have been given a gift from the movie gods.
Yeah, your like target audience.
Your ideal shark movie with Jason Statham and the dude who did the National Treasures movies. I am just all there.
That's fine.
So I'd only ever read the original Meg, and then I also read Hell's Aquarium, which is one of the sequels. And so I'm now going all the way through, and then there's also a prequel. Oh, I think it's a prequel. I haven't read it yet. So I'm working my way through all of them. I am so excited for the movie. It looks like it might be a little bit different from the book, because just going by the IMDb, it looks like in this, and I can see why this would make for a kind of boring movie and would need some retooling, because it's literally a bunch of scientists and doctors
standing
on research vessels going, well, that's a giant shark, isn't it? Yeah. And then they get in like high priced over, equipment and go down. And then there's a shark and it's fucking shit up and it eats a sub. And then they're like, oh, well, we should go back up and do more research on where it may be and follow the migration patterns of the humpback whales and the currents of the warm.
Oh,
yeah. So
I'll wait for the movie. Thank you very much.
I can see why it may need a bit of retooling. I mean, there's lots of blood and the shark likes to eat people. So, but I'm excited to see it. The movie is $150 million budget.
Oh yeah. No, it's
so, it's going to be huge.
It's an over-the-top fun. It's been testing for a long time.
Oh, the movie has?
Yeah. So several of our friends have seen it. Including, I think, Steve Scarlato was telling me about it. And you know how he feels about sharks.
Yeah.
So
it was Steven in.
Yeah, no, it's supposedly a lot of fun.
Okay, that's all I want.
So I think it might be like going for like that Deep Blue Sea style fun
Heck
movie.
Yeah.
Than
I mean, the book definitely kind of gets into the background on Megs and gets into like in it, and this is not a spoiler by any means, the Megalodon glows because it comes from the Marianas Trench. You discover it in the first fucking chapter. Actually, the first chapter is about a Megalodon eating a Tyrannosaurus. You discover it in the second chapter.
Which apparently is not in the movie because they did it in Jurassic World already?
Yes, they did.
Or something similar.
Mosasaurus.
Which is a bummer.
Yeah, it glows in the book, so I'm kind of just excited to see a giant glowing shark on screen. I don't know if they'll keep that, but it's an interesting factor in the book. It's like you always see this glow. So
I like the shark like revival. Like I just watched, I didn't talk about any of the shows because I think you had just saw spoken about it. I watched 47 Meters Down.
Which is a blast.
I actually liked quite a bit.
Not bad.
Really good jump scare.
And I just got The Shallows finally because I have not seen that yet.
Oh, that one I like more.
Yeah.
I definitely am Shallows over 47
But I love
meters,
that
right?
we keep getting every couple of months. Here's another shark movie. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Bring them to me.
Yeah. I'm into it. So yeah. I think I may have to revisit Bait. I haven't seen it in a while.
Bait. Come over. Bait 3D.
Yeah.
Let's do it. So we're going to go grab our guest, and this is going to be a very interesting episode, which you may be, when you see who it is and what the movie is, you may be like, I don't get that. But I've actually known this filmmaker for a really long time, and I think the story of making a sequel to a kind of maligned film 7-8 years later, there's got to be a reason for it. And so we're going to get into that. So we'll be right back after you hear from our sponsors one more time. Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company is Movie Buff owned and operated, and if you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. They're constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website early this year, and ordering has never been easier. This includes lots of hard-to-find titles from Scorpion and Code Red. I personally order all my Arrow stuff from them, so I get the limited edition versions. And there's imports from all over the world, including titles like Camera Obscura, CMV, and more. So go to www.diabolikdvd.com. That's spelled DIABOLIKDVD.com.
Now out on Blu-ray, The Devil's Reign from Severin Films, Ernest Borgnine, William Shatner, Ida Lupino, John Travolta, and High Priest of the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey. Lotus Special Edition with new 2K scan, interviews, commentary, trailers, and more. This one has a limited slipcase edition available only from www.severin-films.com. Heaven help us all when the devils reign. Coming soon, also this is very exciting, the Amicus Collection featuring the Incredible Asylum, and Now the Screaming Starts, and The Beast Must Die, and as they say, the most terrifying movie ever made, and one of the movies I've wanted to see most in my life, Threads, because it made the Time Out or The Guardian, I believe, top 100 horror films of all time. I remember going, what the hell is that? Because I had no idea what it was. It's like a documentary about nuclear war. So that's something to look forward to for completists. Follow Severin Films on Facebook.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. There's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. New this week on Shudder is Sam Was Here. Sam, a door-to-door salesman, travels through the desert in search of clients, with a local radio station as his only contact with the outside world. The strange host, Eddie, takes calls regarding a child killer at large and pushes listeners to hunt the man to death. A paranoid, possibly supernatural mystery, Sam Was Here boasts the intrigue of an extended Twilight Zone episode, forming an evocative thriller you will lean in to figure out. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCKWAVES at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best selection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
Okay, welcome back to the show. So we have a very special guest with us today. And just, it was one of those weird things where timing just worked out. Like we hadn't talked to each other in a while and you just happened to reach out to me and you got a new movie coming out. And I was like, oh, this is the perfect time to talk about it. And you may be wondering why this specific movie. I'm very intrigued by it, by the history of it. And I'm talking about the writer director of Beyond Skyline, which is Liam O'Donnell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Here you are. And here's our history, because we're obviously going to talk about how you got into all this, you know, visual effects, writing. Just off mic, we were talking about Alien versus Predator 2.
Requiem.
So there's a lot of fun stuff to talk about. But more importantly, I had just moved to context. I just moved to Los Angeles, and I was working for Shock to Drop. And I believe that my very first set visit while I lived in town that Ryan Turek sent me on was for Skyline, which was shooting in Marina Del Rey. And so I drove down to the set of this movie, and I had met and just kind of hit it off immediately with the writers, which were Liam and Josh Cordes, mm-hmm. who I still occasionally meet up with to go to the New Beverly.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things where I don't know why, like I chatted with a lot of people, but you guys were kind of my guides on the set, and we just hit it off and started talking. I think I went and visited you guys again while you were still shooting.
I think
so. Even though I had no obligation to.
I didn't know it was your first set visit. You were very professional.
Well, not my first set visit for Shock to Drop.
Okay.
And in Los Angeles.
Rob had been doing this for a while.
It felt like you'd been.
Well, thank you guys. Yeah. You got to pretend like you know what you're doing on every set. But the point being is that I was kind of, you know, there is, and you could maybe talk a little bit about this, but it, you know, obviously the Strauss brothers who directed it had a big history with visual effects in the movie industry. Even though it felt kind of like a small indie movie, because you guys were all doing it together in this giant complex, and yet because of everybody's experience with visual effects, it could be a much bigger movie than it was on paper. But the point being is this: so I had a blast on set. The movie came out.
I know where this is going.
Let's just say that maybe critics and people weren't too kind.
Not very kind. No.
The movie was also, I know we
the kindest thing people call it is divisive.
I remember myself being a little surprised that the movie wasn't what I expected based on what we talked about on set and seeing it and the conversations we had. But the thing that's fascinating to me is, and you've been talking about this as long as I've known you, it's now 7 or 8 years later, and there's a sequel that you wrote and directed. And it's got Frank Grillo. It's got the lead of The Raid, which is a great movie. How did this happen?
It looks huge.
And yeah, why is there a sequel? How did you word it when we were on the phone before? How is there a sequel to a movie that kind of got maligned all these years? Like, how did this happen? Why did you have to do this movie?
It's kind of like time heals all wounds and these sort of things. Like when you come out in a movie gets like savaged like that, like you do just want to lay down for a weekend. I think I was just drinking and just laying in bed for like 48 hours after that. And then afterwards, it comes out on Blu-ray, you watch it again, you're like, oh, that's cool. And then ours went right to streaming instead of HBO. We were in that Relativity deal. Mm-hmm. So it was on Netflix for like a 2.5 year period. I never watched it, kind of like put it out of mind, tried to work on new projects. And then finally, when that deal ended, it played on TV for the first time. I think it was either Spike or Sci-Fi. And when I saw that again in 2013, you know, we had been working on treatments and we had talked to people and investors and stuff like that.
Because it made money, right? I mean, it did well at the box office.
It did decent in America Relativity spent a ton on the P&A. So, you know, it's still in the red in the States, but because they spent so much, that trickles out all over the world and other territories.
Action films usually do really well internationally. So I would assume it did well.
It did crazy numbers over in Russia and Asia and places like that, where sort of there was a kind of a kaiju element to it that we kind of use more in the sequel.
Yes.
But there's a giant monster element. So it made sense that, you know, that did kind of okay in Korea and Japan and places like that. But then actually seeing it on TV, like on the Sci-Fi Channel, Spike TV sort of thing, broken up with the commercials, and seeing it again, I was like, I just enjoyed the aliens again, and I enjoyed the creatures and the world. And I thought seeing it and kind of tweeting along with people, I was like, I think I would kill to make this sequel. Like, I think we could do something really fun with this. I liked the general outline of the treatment that we had. And I just, at that point, kind of, it was the inspiration to like, the window's closing. I've got to really, you know, get this thing off the ground. So.
Were there other films, like, because this is always interesting to me. So before you wrote this movie, the first Skyline, what were you doing in the business?
I had just written a crazy, everything's a little crazy that I do. It's called War of the Ages, and it was like a time travel movie that took Julius Caesar, Napoleon, Genghis Khan.
That's the Avengers of history.
I love that.
It's like awesome. Bill and Ted for a new generation.
You want to know what inspired it? Is that we actually read the script for Justice League Mortal, the George Miller version back then.
Oh, wow.
And they this is right off of them directing AVP. PR, Warner Brothers sent them the script and we read it, we pitched it, and I was like, I'm not that great a writer, but if you just write Batman punches Superman, it's a pretty good sentence, you know? Yeah. I was like, how do I do like an iconic thing like this? Because it was a pretty cool script. I mean, I actually haven't seen the new Justice League, but there was definitely some crazy elements to it, but you know, it would have just changed our entire worlds. Like, there's an alt timeline that movie exists because
George Miller's Justice League
doesn't have the same impact if you've already seen Justice League together. So that was actually one of the inspirations after I read that. I was like, I got to come up with something that's like an iconic coming together. And you know,
so is it like Julius Caesar punches Genghis Khan or like
pretty much like Alexander the Great like betrays Caesar like Caesar was betrayed. It was a lot of fun. You know, I would like use their own quotes from history and dialogue. It was a very nerdy history nerd kind of fan fiction, if you will. Mm-hmm. But we shot like a pretty cool teaser for that up in Tejon Ranch, like north of the city. And that was the first time that we decided we were just going to start self-producing teasers. But it was pretty much the worst possible project that you could self-produce. It's like we have to get wardrobes from five different time periods.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
You have to get horses.
I really want to see this teaser if I could send it to you. Yeah, that just sounds to me too fun to not. Also, I love Time After Time, you know, the one where Jack the Ripper is being chased through time by H.G. Wells. I love that film.
She's had a lot of call for Genghis Khan costumes.
Yeah, well, Genghis Khan would be a badass. Who did you, like, doing the research, did you think who would be the best?
He's the villain. He's like the super villain that I thought, because
and John Wayne could have come back and played him.
I was hoping to get someone
worst casting of all
vaguely Asian descent to play him.
Not John Wayne. Amazing. So bad. But no, I would be kidding. Like, when you research those characters, did you have a feeling like if you did see them together, despite their different styles and fighting styles, who might have been the best, the mightiest of these?
I feel like when you read about it, Khan is definitely extremely impressive. But for the movie, the real villain to me always seemed to make sense would be the earliest person, because these people don't mean anything to him. Mm. So the twist, kind of the midpoint, was Alexander, who was originally the good guys, became the bad guys. Because like if you meet a bunch of people from the future, they're just all, you know, whatever, you're figments. But if you're in the past, or if you're Caesar, those guys all grew up idolizing Alexander. So there would be this like this historical weight. They're not just going to kill this guy. So that was my thought process.
Did you ever see the John Milius documentary?
Just called Milius.
Documents his Genghis Khan epic.
Yes,
that that kills me that wasn't made, because it probably would be amazing.
Oh, you know? So amazing! Yeah. I mean,
his vision, Conan like Genghis Khan, would be pretty badass.
And there's so much of Genghis Khan in Conan, totally. Which is one of my favorite.
It's
movies.
One of the best. Yeah, yeah. So much fun.
So were these projects you were doing specific? You said you guys wanted to kind of make these pitch projects internally. Are you talking about with the Strauss brothers?
Right. Okay. With pretty much, you know, after AVPR,
which they directed, and big visual effects guys.
Right. And I kind of was their like creative consultant on that. I was, you know, 24 years old and I would help them with their pitches and stuff like that. And, so after that, we were doing so many pitches around town, like Justice League and stuff like that. You don't get the job, but you spend a month or two, you know, working your ass off on it. And then you're just like, well, we don't own any of that. We just have, you know, I just had a hard drive full of stuff that we couldn't make, we didn't own. Mm. So I was like, all right, we really need to start developing our own stuff. And so then from there, it was right around the time that the Red camera came out. And so we're like, okay, we can just film the stuff ourselves. But the lesson learned from War of the Ages was, okay, let's try to do something a little bit cheaper, maybe set in the modern day. You know, obviously Paranormal Activity was actually a big inspiration as well, because this guy just made a movie in his house. Like that was a big breakthrough at the time. So we're like, you know, the real kind of simple pitch for Skyline is Paranormal Activity meets Cloverfield. And there you have it.
And the thing is, though, even if you, because you guys shot it mostly in one location, for the most part, which is where I think the Strauss brothers left.
He still lives there. Yeah.
Okay.
And he lives.
But because of the visual effects, it's like, it's not going to be like a Paranormal Activity. You're going to have incredible looking actual Hollywood level effects.
Right. But the thing about it is that I always wonder, and I still, now having done this festival circuit with the second one, is what the reaction would have been to the movie if you had just dropped it on like a midnight screening with real genre fans and just been like, this is, you know nothing about it.
Right.
But getting hit over the head with all this advertisement of a huge sci-fi blockbuster, and then you're seeing, you know, what is a festival midnight movie.
Yeah.
It's probably the worst possible way to go in seeing it, you know.
Plus AVPR was also kind of a mixed reaction, and that was before this, right? Yeah. So it's like from the directors of that last movie that you sort of didn't like.
Right.
So I'm sure it was a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. It was so fast. That movie came together so quickly, and you know, when you're younger, you just don't maybe realize how lucky you are either. Like, we got acquired a month into post production on that, and we only showed them the last 10 minutes.
Oh wow!
And like, we showed them the rooftop sequence at the end, and they're like, "Yep, okay." And you know,
that's a good sale.
I know. And so at the time,
hard to believe they went under.
Says the guy still working.
Yeah, for them, Elric, kind of, don't you kind of work there? I kind there of still,
but I can say what I want.
But you work at Relativity?
The school that was owned by them, now we just changed our name. Okay. A week ago, we are now officially not related.
Wow. So now we can talk shit.
I won't, but you know.
Fling and shade.
I mean, there's a whole story even with that acquiring of like, they were, the number for the P&A was pretty modest, and then once they saw it, they just loved the movie. They saw it and they're like, oh, they kind of pitched it to us a little bit like that Paranormal Story. Like, the story of this movie is how you guys made it. You're a group of best friends. You wanted to make a movie yourselves. You did it in your house. We're going to present that kind of your indie filmmaker outsider thing. And we're like, okay, cool. This makes sense. And then they really liked it. And the guy, he just says, it's Independence Day. And we're like, what part of this? I mean, some shot homages, but it's not Independence Day. Like, right. There's no Will Smith punching an alien in the face. And, you know, they started recording ADR for the TV spot saying, we got to fight back. And they're like, it's a survival film. It's a thriller. And so anyway.
Well, my memory, we may have talked about it when it came out, but my memory of it was when there's, and I'm sorry to spoil the original Scotland, but I'm going to have to. To me, it was like, and it's been years since I've seen it, so you can correct me if I'm wrong. But I remember Eric Balfour's character and the girlfriend end up in the spaceship, right? In the finale.
All my favorite part.
Yes, they end up in the spaceship. Because most of it's just them trying to like survive and get out of this giant complex. So it is a small movie in one setting. But they get in there, right? And doesn't Eric Balfour somehow become an alien or gets in an alien suit or whatever
it is?
He
gets his brain ripped out.
Yes, which is a big – all right. So he gets his brain ripped out and put in an alien suit.
Inserted into an alien brain.
And then the movie ends. And then over the credits is him in an alien body fighting other aliens. And I'm like, I want to see that movie.
Okay,
so it's going over the credits. Hence, this brings us to Beyond Skyline.
I did the credits.
Okay.
So that was kind of – that was the movie I wanted to see too.
Yes, yes.
And so then,
but I feel like that's where this Beyond Skyline must have started. Is all right. I want to see that movie that's in the end credits.
I think it was, like I said, so fast, and like even the night before we did, we only had one day of green screen, so that whole thing in the ship is just a one day shoot, and we just kept making it bigger and crazier and bigger and bigger, and then you can just tell even them as everyone just like the movie wakes up there. It's like it's way more interested in it. And engaged, and it's more visual and dynamic, and you know, it was like, this should have been the end of Act Two. We should have had this whole, you know, different thing for the ending here. And I think maybe if it had had a post process like this one, which was very extended, we probably would have done something like that. But it was like the movie's coming out, and you know, Relativity acquired it in like April, and it released it in November. It was just a really, really fast.
So the first one was a smaller movie that got the huge release, and the new one is a bigger movie that's going more smaller. Yes,
exactly.
And is there thinking behind that? Like
everything's the opposite. Well, this one's just totally independent.
Okay,
and,
it's still an indie.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're being distributed by Vertical Entertainment in the States. Uh-huh. We have a pretty big streaming partner and our, you know, first window after the VOD release. And so it, you know, once you get that big partner, no one else really wants to give you a big theatrical.
Yeah.
So it all kind of worked out.
And was it hard to get this one once you come up and decide you want to do it? How did everything fall together? Like, was it difficult to pitch this? Did the Strauss brothers have any interest in directing themselves again? Or like, how did you pitch yourself as a director? Because this is the first time you've directed a feature yourself, right?
Correct. No, they wanted to direct the sequel back like when after the first movie. And after, you know, that reaction, everything, I think, you know, it just kind of can leave a bad taste in your mouth. So they weren't really, it wasn't on their radar. And we just kind of would take meetings every once in a while with foreign salespeople that would be pitching us financiers and stuff like that. And so it was around 2013. I had come up with another idea that had a lot of interest at like IMAX and Warner Brothers, and they wanted the producers with that one wanted to bring on a bigger studio friendly writer. So it was a little bit of a horse trade where I was like, oh yeah, I'll jump off that. And you know what I'm going to do? I'll write Skyline 2. You know, we have a treatment, but I'm going to write that on spec, but I want to direct it. And they're just like, oh yeah, yeah, cool. You know, it was simple of a conversation. Huh. And then I did the script, that summer 2013, I got pulled off on another project for a while. And then we brought it to Cannes in 2014 to sell, and people were interested. So it started to get, you know, enough foreign sales. And we brought on another producer, Matthew Chouse, who has kind of been kind of my right-hand man on this from the beginning there. And I had been thinking about Frank since I saw Warrior. I was like, okay, yeah, this is guy, he feels like he's a good American cop, you know, action hero. And that was one of the bigger changes I wanted to do just in the genre of what the movie was. The first one's very much like almost a horror setup of just like normal everyday people caught in a bad situation. And this one I wanted to do a more action movie setup, you know, very much deliberately 80s, early 90s action movie setup.
Yeah.
Like, he's a badass cop. He's got a drinking problem. And his damn son just keeps punching people in the face. And he has to bail him out of jail. And that's when everything goes to shit.
It's a beautiful setup.
Now, knowing that so much time had passed and that at this point, because so much time had passed, you could pretty much do anything. Like, you could reboot. You could start over. You could pick up exactly where you left off. How did you pick which direction to go in?
I felt like as much as I complain about anything in the first movie and joke about it, I did feel like I owed some debt to it, and that the people that did enjoy it deserve to have some answers to that cliffhanger, because it's such a big cliffhanger. Like, it needed to be addressed in some way. But there was pressure, for sure, from people all along in different places to just do, you know, a complete reboot. And I thought it was a cool way to kind of do both and have a standalone story, but, you know, build off what was there. Because so much of it is stuck in one POV up on that building. I thought, well, we can go down in the streets in the city and see some of that stuff from another angle. And it's only going to be the first act. We're going to see plenty of new stuff along the way. So, yeah, I had that pressure a couple of different times, but I felt a little bit of debt to, you know, whatever people out there did enjoy the first one. I didn't want to just say, hey, screw you, I'm not going to answer anything about this cliffhanger.
Did the Grillo watch the first one?
He did watch the first one.
The Grillo.
I want to see him do like a podcast talking about the first film.
He would.
All right, this would be better if I was in it right here in this scene.
Pussies.
He pretty much was just like, looked at the VFX reel and was like, all right, you guys know what you're doing with the VFX. And he gave me a ton of notes in the first act. It was like very important to him about setting up the character and little things like you know, like the fact that he hides his alcohol, that was stuff that he kind of came up with. He had a lot of experience with that. So a lot of that stuff, like in the first 15 minutes, was Frank. And after that, he's like, yeah, I don't even understand the rest of the script. You just go ahead and go for it. Yeah.
I just point out to Rob, we have a very special moment where we have somebody who's dealt with the Grillo and also Predator What are we getting towards? Predator Purge?
Oh, he's
going to happen. Purge.
We might have found our director for Predator Purge.
It's been his pitch for, he's like, we need a predator to come down
like
on Purge night.
On Purge night, and everyone's armed, and it's Predator. And now we've got Grillo. We've got the Grill Master. We've got a man who's worked on a Predator Requiem.
I
want to
know how
effects.
He feels about being called the Grill Master.
Now, if only we had Ryan here to pitch it to him.
Yeah, we're in Blumhouse.
I think he's heard this before.
Yeah, but not with this new connection.
Yeah, this is pretty good.
So, we could just do a Predator knockoff. We don't actually.
Yeah, maybe this could just be a fan fiction. Yeah. Mean you can knock.
Yeah.
All right.
So. Yeah, I know guys who make suits.
Okay, we're good.
Well, what about
your costumes? He's just scanning through some pictures.
Yeah,
pretty awesome.
They look incredible.
It looks kind of like as big as Prometheus or something. You know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It looks like a
no, I gotta say, I don't know if you guys had a chance to watch it, but I did. Yeah. And what I am,
I
like,
can't watch a movie like that on computer. Like that's just not me.
Yeah, I watched the first 20 minutes on computer, right up until it started getting alien-y, and then I was like, I need to stop. Plus, yeah, low res.
The visual effects are like out of control. Like that's the most impressive thing about it. And so did you have, like, how did you get away with making it look as big, like all this kind of stuff?
I mean, that's definitely just part of the good thing of making a movie with a visual effects studio.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, I mean, like even the time passed, like we started shooting this in, December 2014.
Oh, wow.
I shot the first week or so, and it was before my suits were even done. So I shot, not to spoil anybody, but the ending's a big battle in Asia at these temples. And we had to use CG creatures for that part, but then we shot a lot of the fights on the back lot. So you'll come in and see, you know, more suit kind of combat. Hmm.
Now with the CG stuff, the monsters were using like a moto, like a motion capture thing where you actually had people there.
I had men in gray leotards on stilts.
Little white stripes.
I
want to
see that version of it.
Yes.
That'd be a good bonus feature. Yeah. I love that. Like just without the visual effects.
We do it in very end of the movie. Okay. There's a bit of a blooper reel where we just show how much of work went into it. And those stilts that we had them on, which Alan Holt is my creature supervisor, and he kind of took that idea from Pan's Labyrinth with the fawn.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he wanted to do that, and it does make the person move like an alien. You know, it's not such a humanoid man in suit look, but god damn it, is it really hard to shoot with, and they fall over a lot, and you're just like constantly nervous someone's gonna
like
tear a knee.
The cast just falls over.
Yes.
Yeah. Like they're just walking and then boom.
Yeah, and like you're in gooey alien environments with a lot of you know, slime on the ground, and it's just it does you'll see on the blooper reel it becomes quite a comedy.
And what about shooting in Indonesia and also the Raid connection? Like, how did that – was that kind of something that came upon early while you were trying to put this thing together, or
– It was the first scout we did of Indonesia. We had, like, dinner with the guys who owned the Infinite Studios, which is in Singapore and Indonesia right over the bay. And they were like, oh, who are you thinking about? Suwa and some of the – you know, they're actually Lao in the story. And we're like, well, you know, we hadn't really gotten into that. We were just in negotiations with Frank, and you know how the movie, it's like you got to cast the lead and everything else kind of follows.
Yeah.
They're like, well, what do you think about the Raid guys for this? And I was like, oh, what? Yeah. Like, of course, that would be amazing. And they're like, we know them, you know, here's their manager. So we called the manager and said, which actually is Gareth's, the director of the Raid's wife, Maya, was their manager at the time.
Oh, wow.
And so we called her and said, you know, we're going to be in Jakarta, you know, this week. Can you meet for lunch? And she said, yes. And then we bought tickets to Jakarta.
Nice.
And it was like, we have to make this happen. And,
yeah.
And we sent them everything. And they had a movie, which is coming out next year, called The Night Comes for Us. With Timo.
Timo Giganto.
Yes. Yeah. Who he's actually an awesome guy. I got to meet him.
Yeah, he's recently. The guy, like, I could just tell at some point he's going to make an amazing movie. Like, he's one of those guys you just are waiting for that big movie. It's going to come. That's the
I think it could be it. They were going to make that back when we were in prep, and it fell apart in that iteration. So they just happened to have like 3 months open. So it was just a lot of luck on some of this stuff, you know?
Wow. Well, excellent. And obviously this comes out on December 15th on all VOD outlets for the most part, iTunes.
All VOD in the UK and Canada and the US.
All right. Wow. And limited theatrical.
Yeah, limited theatrical. You can check my my Instagram or the Facebook page to see like the 10 theaters that we're going to be in. I'm still kind of pushing for a few more, but we'll see.
And, you know, so we went backwards. Usually we start at the very beginning about how people get into this business. Because, again, you know, you have a writing background and then you directed this and worked with a visual effects company. But what were your earliest horror recollections? How did you get into movies in general and specifically the genre stuff, whether it's horror, sci-fi?
Well, I it's funny that there's just so much Predator that we're talking about because it is kind of like my ground zero. Like it's the first grade R-rated movie that I got to see, and I kind of manipulated my situations so that I could sleep over the one kid's house who I knew had it, and his parents like didn't give a shit, and we got to watch that, and I was like that. And that's kind of everything that I love. Is like I definitely love action first and foremost, as and then action, sci-fi, and horror all in one movie is definitely you know kind
Predator's pretty legit.
Yeah, Predator's
great. Let's be honest here.
And you're excited about the new one because it seems like a pretty dream team behind it.
I am, yeah. and I still keep in touch with you know some of the intense Predator fanboys online, and they're like they're trying to slip me the script, and I'm like get that shit away from me. I want to see the movie.
Like an audience.
So
it started with Predator, but did you sense that you would get involved in the film industry in some capacity? When did that become possible for you? And what avenue did you look to break in? Was it always writing?
So my older brother is, you know, always has been an actor. So I would be going to plays a lot as a kid, and I would be even just like in Quincy, Massachusetts. He eventually, you know, went to Juilliard. So I got to see some really great actors that have gone on to do stuff like in these really experimental plays. So, I mean, I guess a career seemed possible because he was doing that, and I got a lot of exposure to acting. But it also, at the same time, like he was really good at it, and it intimidated me to like, oh, I'm not going to, you know, go down that road. But I always loved writing and making my own stories and stuff like that. When I was in college, I did an internship in D.C. Down in the Senate, and so my dad's younger brother is Lawrence O'Donnell. Who has the MSNBC show. And so at the time, he was writing for The West Wing.
Wait, that was your dad's younger brother?
My dad's younger brother.
Because that's so funny, because I just listened to an entire podcast kind of about you, because I listened to him on Mark Maron, where he talked about his entire life and his brothers and his grandfather and your whole lineage.
It's kind of
amazing. Wow. That's so funny, the weird timing.
It's
super weird,
and I learned stuff about my own family and that, because you know you hear the stories from your dad,
but you don't
necessarily hear it exactly from your uncle's side. You know, sometimes we do, and growing up, you know, we'd hear the suicide story, which is my great-grandfather's suicide in front of my grandfather and his brothers, which is kind of like, it's a very
hard-nosed. Wow. Yeah, no, it's a very revealing interview.
It's a Scorsese sort of like scene
that
kind of sets this whole tale in motion. So he was based in L.A. and D.C. growing up, so he was like the uncle that you saw the least. Mm-hmm. And around this time, I started seeing him more, and he had been writing on The West Wing, and he got a spinoff show called Mr. Sterling, starring Thanos, Josh Brolin.
Oh, wow.
So I'm down there in DC, like thinking I'm going to do something in politics, and he's filming a show with Josh Brolin, and he's like, you know, come to the set, come hang out. And it was like, this is a lot cooler than me, you know, giving constituents tours around the Capitol building, which was pretty cool. Yeah. I actually really enjoyed DC, living there and working in politics. But
that uncle of yours is a big fan of the Trump.
No.
He's literally single-handedly fighting him like
We could go on into an entirely different podcast.
It's a pretty amazing. Every time I turn on the TV, it's like him one-on-one taking him. It's awesome.
Well, I enjoy watching it. Did you notice in the Marin podcast, he said there's some people in my family that I'm related to that are Trump voters? That's my father.
Oh,
so
shit.
I'm stuck in
between worlds.
In
between worlds.
Yes.
Yeah. And all Irish Catholic, right?
Irish Catholic.
Yeah, it's for people who are, you know, I watch Lawrence O'Donnell on the show, so I actually like watching it. So when I usually don't listen to Olin Marin, so I was like, oh, that'll be interesting. And it was way more interesting than I was expecting.
I texted him afterwards. I actually listened to it twice because I was on a flight, and I was like, it's an incredible WTF because, you know, he didn't think that we knew what that was. And I'm like, it's kind of everybody's favorite podcast.
Obama was on it. You know, he even had Obama. So.
Wow.
Well, and I've always felt like this is such tangential stuff for our show, but I always thought the character of the newsroom felt like it was based on him to me. Did you know the newsroom with Jeff?
Oh, with Jeff.
Jeff Daniels.
It right,
felt yeah. like that was the type of person it was being based on to me. I don't know.
I feel like that maybe now it seems yeah. more like that. But
probably.
Yeah. I think Aaron Sorkin it was one. Sort of a little bit more Olbermann inspired.
Yeah. Okay.
At the time,
that makes sense. Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because like now.
But he looks more like
right.
him. So that's probably yeah. why. Welcome to Inside Politics.
Yeah, guys.
With your new host.
But anyway, so I did get to hang out with Josh Brolin when I was like 24. And we had like a dinner after that set, and I was the nerd who was like, I loved you in the Goonies.
Hell yes, you did.
Yeah, you did.
And he's like, God damn it. It was like, it just always comes back to that movie. I'm yeah. like, hey, it's you could have a worse movie that it comes back
yeah,
to. It's
yeah.
directed by Richard Donner. It's, you know, produced by Steven Spielberg. And he's like, yeah, you're right.
He was dreamy
yeah.
in it.
Yeah.
Wow. So what was your first gig after that in the business? Like, how did you end up with the Strauss Brothers?
The first gig after that, well, so that was like 2002. And then so 2004, I graduate college and I came out here. I was thinking I would maybe do entertainment law. Like my whole family is lawyers. Mm-hmm. So I'm very unimaginative.
Wow.
And I was like, I could do law, but in the entertainment facility, because I didn't think I could make it any other way. But when I came out here with my friend Matthew Santoro, who's another director, and we just kind of, you know, lived on air mattresses and cheaply, and we worked for what I like to call like pothead production companies, where mm-hmm. they'd pay you in pot and like burritos.
Wow.
And we did local cable commercials and, you know, horror shorts and stuff like that. Like one of the first things I did was the guys kind of like later Michael Myers inspired horror short with like juggalos in it. And I had to try to rewrite it and stuff like that. So I kind of quickly learned that like at that level, at least like nobody knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I just asserted myself, they would just keep giving me more and more responsibility. So that was my main kind of light bulb of like, okay, I can defer for this year and then I'll just keep, you know, doing this stuff. But the first things that I directed under that were not good. You know, they were really cable commercial feeling. And so I met Greg and Colin through those guys as friends of a friend. And they were like, you know, just friendly socializing at first. And then I started pitching them ideas. And they're like, well, can you write? Because our treatment writer is out of town and we have this like eBay China thing. And I was like, yes, I can do that. And so, you know, I started doing those treatments for them and we just immediately started landing a bunch of jobs and it kind of snowballed from there. I just showed up every day. They didn't hire me. I just would come to the office and be like, you guys want to go for a walk and talk about movie ideas? And they're like, yeah, okay. And then I was even more manipulative, just got an apartment. Like I was in Hollywood, but they're down in the Marina. I'm like, just got an apartment like across the street. And in the morning, let's go for walks. Let's talk movie ideas. Let's talk movie ideas. And so it all just kind of came from there. Just kind of hustling.
Wow. Persistence.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And creepy.
Totally perfect for Harsha. So you stalked him. Okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stalking.
Line,
I stalked
yeah.
Frank Grillo. I stalked Greg and Colin. You know, it is a thin line.
How did you get the Grillo? The grill master. How did you get the grill master?
So I was pretty nervous because that summer, Purge Anarchy blew up and one of my friends saw it and was like, oh, you got to see it. There's a similar element because he's, you know, leading a group of survivors through a city.
Mm-hmm.
So I like, it was almost out of theaters. I drove all the way to Norwalk to see it at a theater at like midnight. And then afterwards I was like, okay, it's different enough, especially after page 20, this movie goes in a completely different direction for him. And I sat down and wrote him like this super intense letter, about, you know, what the inspirations for the character were. It was kind of based on my friend's dad, who was a police officer in Quincy, Massachusetts. And, you know, what a big fan of his I was, but in a very specific kind of earnest way. And just sent it out. And I had been writing those letters for, you know, Greg and Colin and other directors that I'd produced for,
mm-hmm.
just because, I don't know, maybe that's a little bit of the liberal arts background. Like I can write a letter or an essay sort of deal. So people have always given that to me. But because it was me finally, like I just felt like I could finally just be honest and not try to write in someone else's voice. So that was freeing and kind of fun. And I was just like, you know, fuck it. He's at the top of the list for the sales company. He's who I wrote it for. Like, we have to go to him. I mean, it has to be that it just makes sense. And
it just kind of fit perfectly within his schedule and everything. And here we are.
Is it, when you sat down with him for the first time, was it as intimidating as I imagine it would be? I mean, I imagine he responded to a letter.
The first sit-down was a Skype. Yeah, so he's responded to a letter because he was living in New York City at the time.
I do not want my Skype to pop up and see Frank Grillo's face. I'd just be terrified personally. But anyways.
I definitely like went to the gym that morning and like had like inspirational music on. Like, I can do this. All right. You know, like Eminem 8 Mile happening. Right. And then like, okay. And, you know, he had a lot of good questions and he was like, you know, this script reads like it's $80 million. How are you going to do it?
Yeah.
And I was like, just don't worry about the visual effects. Like, I'm not worried about the visual effects. That's their problem. Yeah. Let's just talk about the characters. Like, what, how do you see this? What do you want to do? And so I think that made him relax. Like, oh, like he thought I was going to geek out and kind of get technical with him about, you know, that approach. And I was like, it's the furthest thing from my mind. The reason why I want to work with you is I want to learn, you know, from a veteran actor, you know, what is going to make you invest into this movie and how do we make this character work? So
That's pretty crazy, man. Are there, you know, between Skyline and Beyond Skyline, were there other like kind of passion projects that you were trying to get off the ground that maybe now you can kind of return to?
There's definitely a couple of different ones, but I'm kind of moving forward, you know. Mm-hmm. Like the thing that I wrote and I'm really excited about next is kind of, it's a post-apocalyptic gladiator martial arts film kind of set in Indonesia. It was something that I came up with over there, just from scouting around and seeing all these different locations and studying up on Silat, the martial arts, its origins and everything. So it's sort of like a cataclysm happens and this kid washes up on a beach. And so you have this sort of Tarzan-y setup, but instead of apes, it's tigers. And he watches the tigers hunt because that's actually how the mythic origins of Silat is, that they learn from the way tigers fight. And so he kind of gets raised by them. But then in a John Wick style, like hunters show up and murder these tigers and capture him, you know, kind of Conan the Barbarian. They bring him to this, what we now find is to be the post-apocalyptic environment called the Rig, which is like built up on skyscrapers of the flooded earth. And he gets dropped into this like vertical arenas of gladiator fighting.
Damn.
With cybernetic mods.
I love how small you think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Life of Pi and Conan.
Right.
It's like
right.
Boom.
It's totally Conan the Barbarian, like we said. My dog's name is Crom. So there's just I'm obsessed with that.
Well, you know, I always say, you know, I don't want to get too religious on here, but I always say Crom or thank Crom. I never say God. I always say Crom.
They're
pretty much
that.
The same thing, you know, mm-hmm. In my eyes. So.
Because Crom doesn't listen. It's Crom. Honest.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank Crom. So. you know, and well, look, I've seen the new movie. I think it's a lot of fun. It's kind of what I wanted that end credit sequence to be in a movie. And then you threw the dude from The Raid in there and Frank Grillo, and it's just a lot of fun. And the visual effects are amazing. So I think everyone should check it out. On a closing note, do you keep up with the genre, both sci-fi and horror? What is there stuff lately that's been kind of inspiring or that you're really into?
It's interesting. Actually not sci-fi or horror. The movie that I liked the most this year, I did a lot of airplane flights, you know, alone during this festival run. And the one that seems to stick with me that I don't hear anybody talking about was Lost City of Z.
I literally just saw this. I was looking at Amazon at the top of the show and it came up as like a recommendation. And I was like, what are you?
It was a major book. And then I saw the casting. And I was like, oh, that's interesting casting. And then I just, for whatever reason, I haven't seen it. And the director's great.
And having just shot in the jungle and then the movie I just pitched you kind of starts in the jungle. Yeah. There's a lot of jungle photography and it's just shot in a way I would never think to do. And I think that's kind of one of the things that excites me now is like, just seeing people just doing stuff that's so far outside of my skill set and what can I learn from it. But also, you know, I have three small kids and I'm flying around trying to make these movies, and there's something that kind of hit me that he's like this dad, and he's always going over to this jungle, and he's missing time with his children. That was definitely the most tears on the late night flight back. It's kind of poetic, quixotic movie,
and it's an Amazon original available through Prime, so that is getting added to watch list.
and the other good Pattinson performance of the year, because Pattinson's like the revelation
I've heard Good Time's amazing.
Oh, Good Time, he's unbelievable, and so it's like, who
is
this
really
guy?
He's really good in this.
No, I've heard
too.
He's good in this. Yeah. So it's like, where was this guy?
Same as Charlie Hunnam, who I, you know, sometimes is a little stiff.
Yeah.
But I thought I never watched Sons of Anarchy, mm-hmm. so I've only seen his other, you know, big blockbuster mm-hmm. movies. But I really, really liked him in this one.
Huh.
Yeah, and James Gray's made a ton of good movies. They never are like financially successful. Every movie he makes, everyone critically thinks they're brilliant, and then it's crazy.
And this one, like even the jungle feels very intimate, it's not like it's not a Indiana Jones jungle. Which is the way I think of the jungle.
Yeah.
You know,
Our whole generation.
Now, is this action adventure-y or is it far more?
There's
absolutely no genre listed on it.
That's pretty cool that there isn't. I would say it's definitely more 70s, if that is even a thing. Yeah. Like, it's a very old fashioned sort of adventure.
I got to watch it before the year ends because it wasn't hearing that. You're right. Like, I've heard it was good, but I haven't heard anyone particularly say, hey, I loved it. Well, and so it's cool. And
really
that.
Good reviews on
it. Yeah, it's just, to be honest, I've just watched so many of them, and it's the one that comes back. But I think it also has personal meaning
for
me.
Which is the best kind of movie.
The one thing we didn't touch upon that we were starting before before the mics were on. So we were talking a little bit about the Aliens versus Predator movies, and you had said you had just done a podcast on Alien versus Predator Requiem.
Yeah.
What was that podcast?
I just did a podcast for AVP Galaxy, which was a board that, like, you know, we were on a lot while we were making it and, like, you know, interacting with the fans a lot. And then when it came out, they like, we're like, get the fuck off the board.
We've had enough of you guys. In prep for this podcast, you said you revisited the movie.
I hadn't seen it since the DVD came out in 2008. I want to say, I think I watched it with my then girlfriend, now wife, mm-hmm. when we first started dating. There's a lot of great stuff that, as far as the wolf predator and the animatronic face and, now it obviously has a famously bad color grade that was too dark, but with your new 4K TV, you can kind of adjust it and see everything the way it's supposed to be seen now. So that part worked out. It was just like my main takeaway was like, I just don't understand why Fox wanted to make this version of the story. It from the top, the conception is really the most confusing thing when you go back. And that was what at the time was always that we were fighting against. So just trying to make it more connected to those previous entries in the genre that we loved. And it just, you know, from the very kind of concept, it just doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel connected. It is kind of a just too much of this small town slice of life story, interspersed with this really cool creature stuff. And that was my biggest takeaway. I was like, huh, just from the 50,000 foot view, why did they want to do it that way? I still don't quite understand.
Well, I wonder if Paul W.S. Anderson just kind of like put them in that corner with his first movie, mm-hmm. like, you know, because I definitely don't like that one at all. But I don't know. I mean, and they've only done those
but
two.
But the first one is like, to defend his movie, it's very much like it stars Lance Hendrickson. It's got the Wayland company involved. It's got an exotic environment that changes. It's got a lot of mythology and the predators. You know, it just it does feel more connected, and it had a much bigger budget than the second one did, and so I think it was just kind of like, here's the budget, try to figure out a movie within those constraints. But I did hear that they were like, before we were involved, the original idea was that it would crash in Afghanistan, and I was just like, that made me so sad that wasn't what, you know, it eventually was. Cause I feel like that's really the type of movie that Greg and Colin were like born to make, like just a full war movie. Mm. And they kind of got stuck, with this other version that, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah.
crazy times. But you know what? It, regardless, you still got to kind of, I think it's still kind of fun that you get to be on set with those aliens and predators. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been to the, who are the guys?
ADI.
I've been to ADI's, you know, Woodruff and just seeing that stuff in person, you're kind of like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, they have like the evolution setup where they've got a couple of different alien suits and a couple of the different predator suits.
Yeah, and you're like, it's pretty cool to see them in person.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, yeah, I actually, my foot is covered in alien goo at one point. I played like a homeless dead guy. so, and then, yeah, like I, the first, my biggest memory of that is just seeing a predator on, like for the first time
in real life.
Yeah, in real life. Person. They called us over and all of a sudden he, like the three laser dots went up the ground onto my chest and I was just like,
Do you guys remember the comic? I think it was Predator versus Batman. They did a that was cool.
They did an Alien versus Predator versus Batman.
Yeah,
done,
that was cool though.
Know, there's so Robocop many great Terminator. Versions of it. You know, one of the pitches we were like trying to think of at the beginning was like Fire in the Sky, you know, version where people get abducted onto these Predator ships
as
and then,
a battle
then
kind
an
of
egg
thing.
Opens and then you get put into these training zones for young predators to train and stuff. It was like there's so many
that's
different.
Already better.
It feels like a sci-fi.
I kind of want to see that movie now. You don't mind
throwing Christopher Walken as Whitley Strieber? You've got a movie. Boom.
Yeah.
Boom.
Right. So there's all these different the things that just seem more connected. So that's really just the tragedy of it. But I don't want to sound like I'm complaining because yes, it was like film school working with my two favorite creatures and getting to work with Tom and Alec. Who, you know, we developed another couple of projects with them, and they worked on the first Skyline, and I used a lot of those designs that they did in the sequel. So.
Yeah. I got to tell you, and I think I've talked about it on the show, but like, to me, one of the highlights was Universal Horror Nights when they did an Alien versus Predator maze. Cause you know, you see the movies and you get to a point where you're at an age where it's not as scary anymore. Cause you're like, oh, I know what they look like, whatever. But walking through mazes where it's freaking aliens and predators after you is fucking terrifying. There's like one room where there's glasses and you see like all the, you know, the cases with the face huggers are all broken. And so you walk through the room and as soon as you get near the window, a face hugger just like bounces off of it.
It was great.
And it's like scary shit. But the thing that was amazing to me that I'll never forget is they had a life-size queen. So there's a room where it's like flashing strobe lights that you have to run through that the queen is like growling at you and drooling. And you're just like, if you saw that in real life and I was seeing it in real life, you're like, your mind can't comprehend.
Yeah, that's
like,
cool. I don't feel like
it's amazing.
It was
yeah.
by far one of the best mazes of that year. I think
that
it was,
3 years
ago they did that one.
About three years ago.
I think I remember
that. But I mean, when you get to see them in person, especially the queen, you're just like, holy shit, I would not be able to survive this thing. But anyway, Liam O'Donnell, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for joining
really appreciate
us.
It.
Thanks, guys.
Quite a story. Beyond Skyline is out December 15th. So check it out and let us know what you think.
Thank you.